Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 102, recorded Thursday, November 29th, 2012. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: Trip Management App Bake-Off and TSA Scanner Shuffle. Coming to you again from Travel Commons Studios outside of Chicago. I wasn't able to get to a hotel and get this podcast out by the end of the month. Stuff didn't come together. It was an uneventful Thanksgiving Day weekend. Uneventful for me, at least, because I was able to hold fast to my rule of no travel during the Thanksgiving holiday. I woke up last Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving, to see nothing but gray outside my window. Heavy fog hit Chicago. Not a normal event, but, you know, kind of, if you give that nod to Murphy's Law, if it was going to happen, if you were going to sock in O'Hare with fog, why not do it on the busiest travel day of the year? About 1,500 flights, I think, ended up being delayed and canceled. Just goes to prove out my rule. Now, earlier this month, though, I did get sort of slightly winged by the weather gods. I traveled to New York the week after, I don't know, what is it, Hurricane Sandy, Superstorm Sandy? I thought it was a Category 1 hurricane when it hit New Jersey. And so I don't know what's with all the superstorm stuff. I mean, what is a superstorm? Anyways, I landed LaGuardia the Tuesday morning following the Sandy thing, and I'm expecting a real hassle getting into Midtown, but no, to my very pleasant surprise, there were loads of cabs and no queues. Talking to a colleague later that day, actually, he'd flown into Newark the night before, and he ended up waiting 2 hours for a car. So, you know, timing with these travel things is everything. It's quite honestly, it's often better to be lucky than smart. And pretty soon, I thought I'd used up all my luck in the cab line, because while I dodged Superstorm Sandy, I'd landed 18 hours in front of the follow-up nor'easter that the Weather Channel had decided to name Winter Storm Athena. Okay, so now we got hurricanes, we got superstorms, and we got winter storms, all with names. I mean, go figure. All I know is that I land in perfect weather on Tuesday morning, and by Wednesday afternoon, I'm watching snow blow sideways down Central Park South. Of course, in this age of airlines maxing out seat occupancy, they start preemptively canceling flights the day before Athena hits. So Tuesday night, American and United were already canceling flights for Wednesday afternoon through Thursday morning. United a bit more cautiously starting their cancellations at Wednesday noon, while American, perhaps trying to squeeze out a bit more revenue, I think waited until about 2. Actually, my luck was holding, though. I wasn't scheduled to fly back until Thursday at 3. So if this nor'easter hits when it's supposed to and moves through as fast as it's supposed to, I could come out of this okay. On Wednesday, I kept looking out the window of the conference hotel. About 3, a little bit ahead of schedule, I start to see the snow fly. By 5, when I walked out of the conference to meet a friend for a beer, it was a full-on blizzard. A sloppy walk back to my hotel. I don't know, seems like nobody in Manhattan owns a snow shovel. But looking out the hotel window Thursday morning, it was clear sidewalks and sunny skies. My flight out of LaGuardia was delayed, I don't know, maybe 40 minutes, which even on a good day with no problems qualifies on time for a LaGuardia to O'Hare flight. Lucky, because I tell you, I couldn't have planned it better if I'd tried. Following up, you know, got some good comments on the O'Hare layover video that we talked about in the last episode. Jeanette Irwin left a comment on the website asking, "I've often wanted to take advantage of long layovers by making a quick trip into the city the airport's in, but I've never been able to figure out what to do with my luggage. If I can help it, I don't check my bag, but bring it on the plane with me. Do you have this issue as well, Mark? If so, what do you do about it?" Well, Jeanette, I think any experienced traveler is going to have this issue because we all pretty much break out in hives and a cold sweat at the idea of checking a bag. However, with increased airport security after 9/11, short-term luggage checks are scarce, if not extinct, in the U.S., and they're increasingly expensive in places that still have them, like Heathrow. I'll grit my teeth and check my bag if I know I'm doing a layover tour. I did this for my Frankfurt sprint that I did a video for. If it's a more spontaneous excursion, though, I'll try and check my bag at an airport hotel or at a hotel near my first stop. I'm usually successful at this. I just tell them I'm checking in later and that my room isn't ready. But I also generously tip at the front end to the guy taking my luggage to, you know, grease the skids a little bit. Gary Learned and Steve Frick gave answers to the question I posed in that last episode and when we were talking about layovers. You know, and the question was, how many of the top 10 U.S. hubs, Atlanta, O'Hare, Dallas, Denver, Phoenix, Minneapolis, Houston, Detroit, Newark, SFO, how many of those could you do a five-hour city neighborhood tour through without needing a rental car? Now, after checking off the easy ones in the last episode, O'Hare, Newark, New York, and San Francisco, I asked for thoughts about the rest. So Gary weighed in on Minneapolis via Twitter. He said, you can take the light rail into downtown Minneapolis or over to the Mall of America. And I'll tell you, from my experience, once then you get to downtown Minneapolis, you never have to come outside. You just wander sort of building to building through the 8 miles of human habit trails called the Skyway. I mean, some people, you know, go weeks in the winter without venturing outside. Given the weather in Minneapolis in January, not such a bad idea. Steve Frick said you could MARTA up to downtown Atlanta. There's plenty to do in a five-hour time span. Steve must have also followed the link in last episode's show notes to the Travel Commons Flickr page because he also commented, I was looking at your Flickr pictures. Take a look back at your My Briefcase picture from 2006. Travel technology certainly has evolved in the past 7 years. Yeah, Steve, I did go back and look at that picture. It's the first picture in the Travel Commons Flickr photo stream from February 2006. I'll also put it in the show notes for this episode. When I was thinking back on it, it also accompanies an audio tour that I took through my briefcase in episode 33. All right, so let's see what is in my briefcase. I've got an IBM ThinkPad X31. It is absolutely the lightest one I could find. I've got a tin of Altoids Curiously Strong Wintergreen Mints, two USB thumb drives, a 512 meg and a 256 meg, three different kinds of ZipLink retractable cables. One's RJ45. And that comes in very handy in hotel rooms when you're connecting to the broadband modem there, rather than having to go and fish around in the closet. So then I also have a Bluetooth USB dongle. I don't even remember who made this. And I use that to interface with my Motorola V551 mobile phone. And then with that also goes H550 Motorola Bluetooth headset. I absolutely love that.
Now that tour went on for 4 minutes. Amazing what I used to podcast. Well, anyhow, there you go. Using a Bluetooth dongle to push photos from my Motorola clamshell phone to my ThinkPad. I mean, that was cutting edge pre-smartphone stuff. You look at the picture, the U2 Clickwheel iPod also has a bit of a vintage feel, though when I heard Vertigo on the radio the other day, it didn't seem 7 years old. Now, some things haven't changed, though. I still record my podcasts on that little iRiver, much to my chagrin. I actually ended up, I bought that thing off of eBay. I still use Pilot G2 gel pens, and I still carry a tin of wintergreen Altoids to get rid of that, you know, plain nap taste in my mouth. I think about half the stuff in my briefcase has stayed the same since 2006. I don't quite know what that says about me. One of the things that has changed since 06 is the creation of a whole new class of travel electronics, the tablet. The iPad and the Kindle are sort of the two defining devices in that category. Now, just before Thanksgiving, I picked up a Google Nexus 7 tablet, the competitor to the Kindle Fire and the iPad Mini. The Wi-Fi only version has been out since the summer, but I waited to buy until they'd released a version with cellular data, and also after I'd seen Apple's 7-inch offering. I'll do a full review of the Nexus in a later episode after I've had a chance to travel with it a bit, but I'll tell you, after a week and a half of use, I really like it. The hardware is nicely put together. The price is right, about $260 cheaper than a similarly kitted out iPad mini. And the latest version of Android 4.2 or Jelly Bean is sort of hugely better than the first tablet version of Android, which was 3.0 or Honeycomb and sort of the dessert nomenclature that came out sort of 18 months ago. I'll tell you, all in all, the Nexus 7 leaves me with a very positive first impression. If you have a question, a story, a comment, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email address, as always, comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com. You can use the Voice Memo app on your iPhone or something like Easy Voice Recorder on your Android phone or tablet to record and send in an audio comment. You can send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, or you can post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page, or you can always post them on the website at travelcommons.com. So the first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is the Trip Management App Bake-Off. You know, back in the golden age of travel, when everybody dressed up to fly, or at least showered and shaved, you know, flight attendants still had their pensions and so were much more pleasant. First-class food was served on china with real silverware, and there was legroom and coach. Back then, frequent travelers used travel agencies to book their travel. I mean, before you left on a trip, they'd send you an actual physical plane ticket and a printed itinerary that consolidated your flight, hotel, and car reservations into a single page. They usually gave you three copies of the itinerary, one for your admin, one for your spouse, and one for you. Now, in today's sort of DIY, do-it-yourself age of travel, where people are searching and booking their own travel components a la carte, you'll say using HintMonk for flights, Orbitz for hotels, and, I don't know, booking a car directly with Avis, and then want to share these plans with sort of 450 of their geographically distributed friends, you know, there's a need to update those paper itineraries with something a bit more interactive, something, you know, that maybe leverages the $1 billion of mobile stuff we've bought over the past few years, certainly since I've taken that picture of my briefcase in 2006. Now, I've used a number of these travel management applications, TripIt, TripCase, WorldMate, since I got my first iPhone, but had never really compared them to one another. I just had them all running at the same time. I eventually settled on TripIt, quite honestly, for no other reason than the travel management software my company used was Concor Solutions, and Concor bought TripIt and then integrated it into their offering. So, you know, it was just a default decision. Well, it's been a while since I've really looked at all of these apps. They've all been updated. Different things have happened. So I thought this was a good time to give them another spin. I used my Winter Storm Athena New York trip on United and an upcoming Salt Lake City ski trip on Southwest as sort of test beds for the comparison. I loaded the free versions of TripIt, TripCase, WorldMate, and Kayak on my iPhone 5 and also on my Samsung Galaxy tablet that's running the Jelly Bean version of Android. Kayak wasn't in my first initial passive apps. I think of them more as a meta search than travel management, but Gary Learned in a Twitter conversation pointed me to them, and after I looked at them, I said, okay, I'll add them to the mix. And then adding to the fun, I also have Flight Track Pro and the United Airlines app on my iPhone, and also end up using the Passbook app that's new to iOS 6 to hold my United boarding pass. So all that being said, I was fully apped up and ready to go. Now, all the apps hit the base use case of aggregating trip information and effectively displaying it on the screen of a smartphone or tablet. Now, everyone correctly parsed the United and Southwest confirmation emails and noted the Vegas stopover on the return leg of the Southwest trip. And then TripIt, WorldMate, and Kayak went a little bit farther, explicitly calling out that it was a 40-minute stopover. Now, most apps also have some way of automatically ingesting your travel plans. Now, if your business uses Concor, then you can have it send all your itineraries automatically to TripIt. TripCase, owned by the Sabre Travel System, can automatically pick up trips made by a travel agent that uses Sabre. I assume that WorldMate will do something similar with Carlson WagonLeet after Carlson finishes that acquisition. And though I didn't try it, I'd guess that Kayak sort of automatically loads trips you make through them. You can also, separately of that, you can also authorize TripIt to scan your Gmail account, several times a day for confirmation emails if you have those emails sent over there. If aggregation is the first use case, then sharing itineraries is the second. Now, in this day and age, people immediately translate that sharing into social media posting, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, or the usual suspects. But there are different levels of sharing needed. I mean, I might want to post to Facebook and LinkedIn that I'm planning a New York trip, sort of trolling for some serendipitous beer drinking, but not so sure I want to widely broadcast my flight and hotel details. However, someone that's scheduling my meetings or picking me up at the airport, not to mention also my wife, not only do they demand those details, they could probably use delay and reschedule updates also. So everyone handles what I'd call the base social media sharing, publishing to Facebook and LinkedIn, though it didn't appear that WorldMate pushed to Facebook automatically. Now, I like TripIt's two pushes. I'm planning a trip when I book the trip, and then I'm leaving that they pushed the day before departure. Kayak's pushes bothered me. They're basically URL links to the itinerary, which I think makes way too much information available to a broad number of folks. TripCase and Kayak could also push to Twitter. TripIt couldn't, but they could push to enterprise social apps like Salesforce.com's Chatter and Yammer, which was just bought by Microsoft. TripIt, TripCase, and Kayak all published web calendar feeds that you can pull into Outlook or Google Calendar, which would allow your spouse or assistant to get regular updates of your detailed travel plans. WorldMate's Calendar Sync isn't available in their free product, so I didn't look at that. All that web calendar stuff is nice to have, but sort of basic gut level, I want to email the itinerary to somebody now that's key. And I got to tell you, I was a little surprised at the results. I mean, you'd think this would be easy. And for WorldMate and TripCase, it was. Click on the share button, and they quickly shot out a one-page email with all the trip details kind of laid out in a nice table. I was surprised, though, that TripCase was the only one where I could, sort of as a global default, set up, say, my wife's email to automatically get all of my trip updates, as opposed to having to remember to hit the share button and send her an email each time. However, to do so, she had to become a TripCase user, which was not quite what I had in mind. Kayak and TripIt sent out emails with web links to the information. Now, clicking through Kayak's got a nice clean display of the itinerary, an extra step that I don't think is needed, but okay. TripIt, though, made you sign up as a TripIt user before you could see the travel details on the website. So, that just to me felt like way too much work if I need to quickly share my travel plans with a colleague. So at this point, everyone was able to aggregate travel plans, with some apps having a convenience edge if you book through their partners, Concor for TripIt, Sabre for TripCase, Kayak for Kayak, I guess. TripIt and TripCase do the best with social media publishing, though TripIt wins if your company uses Yammer or Chatter. TripCase and WorldMate end up winning the itinerary emailing with TripIt just sort of epically failing. So that's mostly pre-trip stuff. The final use case, really sort of the acid test, is while you're on the trip and something happens, what airlines euphemistically call irregular ops. The sort of things that happen when you're traveling through LaGuardia in the midst of, say, I don't know, a winter nor'easter big enough to get its own name from the Weather Channel. Flights are delayed, gates change. Now, since I was only using the free versions of apps, TripIt and WorldMate didn't help. You have to upgrade to their paid versions for flight tracking and updates. Now, having said that, you know, WorldMate Gold is $10 a year, while TripIt Pro is $49. You know, not huge numbers, especially WorldMate's. But somewhere along the line, though, I'd bought this Flight Track Pro for my iPhone. It's a $10 app now on iTunes, although only $5 on Android. But I got to think when I bought it for the iPhone, it was cheaper. I don't think I spent $10 for it. Anyhow, it syncs with TripIt. Pro version syncs with TripIt. So I was kind of getting updates from TripIt that way. And in the same way, WorldMate's free app provides really a nice deep link into flightstats.com from its trip page. So literally sort of two clicks, no typing, and you've got real-time flight info for your flight. Not as good as a push notification, but it's something. So anyhow, from the free services, I got the best notifications from TripCase and Kayak. TripCase through the iPhone notifications, Kayak via email, and both of them were faster than the airline, United in this case. I mean, I couldn't even get gate information updated on my United boarding pass and passbook, and trying to get push notifications from their app is sort of a random walk through a bunch of screens. Now, though it's a paid app, Flight Track Pro did a great job of pushing gate change and delay notifications to my iPhone, and the app does a nice job of displaying current weather on a map, which, you know, can give you a sense of how much trouble you're in. So when we sort all this bake-off down, I think TripCase ends up winning as the best free smartphone app. It was at the top of all three use cases, itinerary building, sharing, and then real-time flight status updates. However, it doesn't have a tablet-specific app. It just sort of scales up the smartphone app, which looks awful on my 10-inch Samsung Galaxy Tab. WorldMate, Kayak, and TripIt have good iPad apps, but only TripIt and Kayak have apps specifically for Android tablets. And looking at those apps, both on the Samsung and then later on the Nexus 7, I like the TripIt layout and the accompanying screen widget that you can put on your Android home screen. I like that a lot better than Kayak's, but Kayak's got that real-time flight status in the free app that, that TripIt just doesn't. So if I've got TripCase on my iPhone, so if I'm traveling both with my iPhone and my tablet, then I give the Android tablet win to TripIt for a much more usable app on the tablet. If I've only got my tablet, though, and I don't have my smartphone, then I can't give up the real-time flight status updates, and I have to take Kayak. Okay, so I've rambled on. I'll tell you, this was, at least for me, a good exercise, both in making me sort of think through the use cases and then walking through that evaluation. As a longtime TripIt user, I got to tell you, it kind of surprised me. But, you know, I mean, after Angry Birds, Trip Management is probably the most important app that a frequent traveler uses. So there's my cut at it. Let me know your thoughts. I mean, what do you use? What do you think about the use cases? What do you think about the evaluation and the results? Twitter, Facebook, email, website comments, carrier pigeon, sort of all the usual comm channels are open. Let me know what you guys use, what you think, and we'll talk about it in the next episode. Second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is the TSA scanner shuffle. You know, just when you thought that I'd make it through a podcast without a TSA item, here it is, my favorite topic, full body scanners. We've talked many, many times about the full body scanners that the TSA uses in U.S. airports. And for the sake of longtime listeners, I will not summarize my rants. I'll just leave it as you can figure that I'm not a big fan. Now, there are two kinds of full-body scanners. Backscatter that uses X-rays to produce sort of the near-naked images that we've seen in newspaper articles. And I actually, I've got a copy of one from the TSA in the show notes for this show. And then there's millimeter wave machines that produce sort of more generic stick figures. A few months ago, the TSA started swapping backscatter machines for millimeter wave machines at high-volume airports like Logan, LAX, O'Hare, to speed up the security lines. I mean, though you still have to pull everything out of your pockets, the processing time for millimeter wave machines from sort of the scan to the all clear is, in my experience, at least, you know, half. It takes at least half the time of the backscatter machines. Those slower backscatter machines were supposed to be, according to the TSA, redeployed to smaller, lower volume airports. However, just before officials testified to Congress a couple of weeks ago, mid-November, I think it was like around November 15th, the TSA announced that these 91 backscatter machines that they were pulling out, which are worth about $14 million, were actually going to be sent to a Texas storage warehouse. Space constraints in the smaller airports and some suspicions of manipulated test results of the new privacy software by the backscatter machine manufacturers. Those were the reasons for kind of redirecting these machines into storage. Now, of course, if you look at this, this is the second multi-million dollar mistake the TSA has made with passenger screening technology, at least from a scanner standpoint. Now, if you traveled through San Francisco airport, say, 5, 6, 7 years ago, you might have gotten a chance to walk through a puffer machine where you walked in, it puffed two, three bits of air around your feet, and then sucked up that air and analyzed it for explosives. Worked real well in the lab, but completely failed when faced with the muck that sort of floats around a real-world airport. The TSA spent $30 million on 94 puffer machines, deployed less than half of them, and finished pulling the last ones back out of the airports in 2010. So it's no wonder that the congressional subcommittee chairman in mid-November said, you know, during his hearing that he was really aggravated by the situation, saying that the country is really struggling with some tough budgetary decisions, and it's really hard to understand how this happens. I mean, I'll tell you, it doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. You just have got to be disgusted by the waste. I mean, it just reinforces the sense that the TSA has never been much more than sort of a real expensive piece of security theater. As the U.S. sort of slouches toward the brink of a fiscal cliff and has to make hard decisions about raising taxes and cutting entitlements, I'll tell you, we can no longer afford the TSA to take another $14 or $30 million away from schools or Medicare or pull it out of taxpayers' pockets. I mean, it's just a money pit that we've got to walk away from. Okay, so now I'll tuck my soapbox away. And until the next episode. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 102. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. The bridge music on today's show is from Mevio's Music Alley, music.mevio.com, Mo Shang by Soli, You're the Big Sky by Derek K. Miller, and Sliding into Slumberland by Little Stevie and the Fat Rats. Now, I got to tell you, that last piece of bridge music was like one of the mellower pieces of music that I've played, and to have it done by a band called Little Stevie and the Fat Rats, just I don't know, there's a huge disconnect. Well, anyhow, check out the show notes for a link to the Mevio site. And as always, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, moans and groans, you know, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, or to M. Peacock at Twitter. Write them on the Travel Commons wall on Facebook or post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, and post comments on the website. You help me generate content for this podcast. So here you go. Sorry I didn't get this to you before Thanksgiving so that you had something to listen to while the fog set in. But hopefully it'll keep you company while you're flying to wherever you're flying to for this Christmas holiday. If I don't talk to you before then, have a great holiday season. Take care, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.
Life is hell, strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing needs my mind, the warm woman that I left behind. From California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing finer. And when the tears start falling, crying into the phone, within my heart you'll find my pictures of you at home. No matter where life takes me, how many miles I roam, I close my eyes.